Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org. It's the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, or the unseen universe, or the universe all around us. I would like to acknowledge WNAH. That's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse. We call him Tony the Horse because it's a one-man show. Well, it's a two-man show. Tony is the guy who brings in the money. So Tony's the horse. They call Hoyt is the station manager, and he is WNAH. He hasn't taken a day off, I think, in 8 or 9 years. Not one day. And before that, I think he only took a day. It's really quite amazing. I don't know how he does it. I seem to gravitate towards the insane. And if he's not insane, then I must be, because I think it's crazy. But we like to think of some people as being eccentric. Although my experience is that you have to be rich is usually eccentric. The poor have to settle for crazy.
There you go.
And they afford us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. In other words, they don't charge me a nickel for doing that. There's no money being made on Rum Radio. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals. They afford us some print space from time to time. As a matter of fact, I have to call them. I have two of my stories in there, and I haven't seen any print. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country. Something I wanted to add because of the tragedy in Sandy Hook, and some fellow in my church had come up with a solution. And, you know, you've heard many of the solutions. People say, well, it's a mental health problem, and it's a spiritual problem and all that. And I believe it's really excessive internet gaming and a lack of parental guidance and control. That's my personal feeling. But one of the fellows in my church came up, he wrote to the school board, and we're in Texas. So we're a gun-toting state here, folks. So we got lots of guns here, a lot of hunters. It's a gun society. It's a gun culture here. We're allowed legally to carry a firearm with license. We have to get a license to do that as long as it's concealed. Anybody within the parameters of the law can carry a weapon. And his suggestion was, and then he told me they're doing it in a couple of schools here, that the teachers and the principals be armed, that they have the ability, you know, they have to be licensed and go through that as part of the curriculum, that they're licensed to carry a firearm, and they carry the firearm with them when they're in school. And makes a good point, because when something like that happens, you have to react within seconds. Even though the police might be minutes away, it's important to realize that you only have seconds to react. These are not becoming isolated. There's a lot of kids like that. And so much gaming, rewired brains in a two-dimensional reality. We live in an analog world. Basically, the sociopaths. They can't relate in an analog world. So as heinous as that crime is, I'm sure to the kid that was doing it, there was probably a mental health issue, my guess. I will never really know for sure. They'll dig it out. But I would bet internet gaming was a big part of this, isolation for long periods of time. He's not the only one out there, folks. There's a lot. I see the kids coming into AA and NA. You know, they're lost. It's a lost generation. It's drug addicts and alcoholics raising drug addicts and alcoholics with no parental guidance. The family is really deteriorating around us, and these are the consequences that we're looking at now. Well, that's enough out of me. Harold, I want to...
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Joseph. It's nice to be with you on the program, and I'm looking forward to our guest speaker tonight. I just wanted to take a minute to remind everyone that this is not a profit-making effort. There's no money made by this website or the radio program. It's really our way of giving back. I owe my life to the 12 steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, other 12-step programs, including Celebrate Recovery. And I just want to find as many ways as I can to give back. I do help families, and I work with other alcoholics. That not only helps them, but it helps me stay sober. There's nothing like trying to teach something to help you see where you have gaps in your own knowledge that need to be filled with extra study. So I've been at this for almost a quarter of a century. By December 28th, God willing, I'll have 25 years of continuous sobriety and recovery, which is a little bit different. And so I just wanted to thank Joseph for creating the website, rumradio.org, and focus on working with others, because that's really the key to this thing. Everyone in the 12-step program is actually being prepared to work with someone newer in the program than they are. And that's what makes this thing go. It always has since 1935. We have an effort to get back to basics and to undo some of the myths that have crept in to the program. And so some of the things that we have to say are counterintuitive. You wouldn't think it works that way, but it does. So we're returning to basics, and I appreciate Joseph for rumradio.org. And you can follow along with us and understand more about working with others by going to the website. And he keeps expanding it. He keeps spending money on it. And we have quite a few hits in quite a few countries, and it's really, really great to hear. I just wanted to take 1 second to mention that the NRA made a speech a couple days ago and said that the only thing that will stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And he proposed placing highly trained armed guards at each school. And we have them at the banks. We have them at the sports stadiums. We have them surrounding the president and the congressman. And so anything that we consider important has armed guards. Why not our most precious item in life, which is our kids? They are gifts from God, and we have a duty to protect them. So that's one idea. I don't think it'll be met with much. Well, it's been proposed before and rejected numerous times, and it'll probably be rejected again. But I don't know if I want my teachers to have guns. But we can train some armed guards and see the shooter in Colorado pick the one theater where guns are banned, knowing that he probably wouldn't be shot and would be able to carry out his mission. In Oregon, the mall shooter was stopped when a citizen with a gun stopped him. He came up, he was approached by a man with a gun, 22 years old, and that's when he stopped shooting other people and put the gun to himself. And that stopped that incident. That's not very well publicized by the press, but that's how that one stopped. Somebody with a gun protected themselves and protected the other 10,000 people that were in the mall. So let me turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, that's a good debate. I think the reason why the armed guards is a cost issue. They don't want to spend the money. They barely can pay for the teachers as it is. So the teachers really, I think, personally, would be the obvious, since you're already paying them a salary and you don't have to pay it anymore, or you could, but not much. So, you know, you already have the labor in place. And then the education, the gun control, was right there. So, and then, of course, if the kid gets out of line and he's disrupting the class, he could just shoot him. that'll quiet them down. That's for sure. Hey,
you know, in California, not only do they don't want to carry guns, they don't want to even give grades, because some of the kids' feelings will be hurt. So but that's
really,
another topic.
Anyway, that's another time. I want to introduce our guest, Vincent J. Did you want to use your last name? Feel free. Was born in Hollywood around the circa 1950, and today lives and writes in Southern California. What was the thing about Southern California? Is that that's where all the pretty girls are? Is it two boys for every two girls for every boy? Is that Southern California, or is it Surf City?
Well,
right?
It's a land of fruit and nuts, actually. So
fruit and nuts, lots of fruits, and enough nuts to make everything go around.
Well, that's why the meetings are so well populated. Yeah.
He's a writer, radio and vocal. He does radio and vocal characterizations. Were his early loves until drugs and alcohol derailed his life, and after a brush with death, he embarked on the work of reigniting a true love, writing. So he's a writer, and a lot of his passion is in 12-step recovery. So if you just hold on there for a minute, Vincent, I just wanted to start off with a third-step prayer. But the third-step prayer, this is not, there's a disclaimer. I like to do that in the sense that it's part, I'm not AA, Rum Radio is not AA, it's Rum Radio. We don't represent Alcoholics Anonymous or NA or CA. We're probably closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. We're independent, although the information that we use comes from the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Big Book. It's called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the basic text for all 12-step programs. How do you like that? This is the template, the mother of all 12-step programs, as you would say. The 12 steps are in there, and all the variations and derivations come from this basic text. And I like to use the prime basic text, although I understand the Green Book for NA is really well-written and very spiritually inclined. Not to take away anything from anybody, but I find the Big Book to be sufficient to my needs. But I think I'm open-minded. I'm looking forward to reading the Green Book also and getting a little bit more into that. Today I don't see as big a difference as it was years ago between the drug addict and the alcoholic, because alcohol is a drug. And more people die from overdosing on alcohol than anything else. So we're surely we're not brothers. We're surely kissing cousins. How I use the third step, it's also called the surrender prayer. When someone comes into the rooms and they've decided that they've had enough, or they've agreed to come up and get a beginner's chip, and a lot of clubs use that and groups use that. It's an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours, just one day. Can you do it for one day and see how that works for you? And if you get up and do that, you take that walk, and that's an admission that there is a problem. Until there's an admission of a problem, no matter how hard you try, you're not going to find a solution until a problem is acknowledged. Gets up, he gets his chip. Hopefully he gets to say his name, and it's a wonder if he can get to say, "Hi, my name is Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic." And that's hard, hard to say. First time I said it, it got stuck in my throat. Couldn't quite get it out. Nobody likes to think that they might be lesser than their fellows, and then to acknowledge it in front of a group is very humbling, to say the least. But once it's out, the cat's out of the bag. So now we look for a solution. I circle up with the guy. We usually have a prayer. I circle up. I grab his hand. So now I got him by the hand. And Big Book on page 89 says, go find the prospect and start working on him. Doesn't say go have the prospect find you. This guy doesn't know anything. He knows he's in pain, he's in trouble, and you might have the solution, but he's really not quite sure if it's going to work for him or not. But he's willing to, at least to go this far. So after the prayer, we have a little prayer, usually the Our Father, a third step prayer, some kind of chant. And after that, I turn around to the new man and I say, "Have you had enough? Yes or no?" If he's had enough, he'll say yes. Sometimes they'll ask, "What do you mean, have I had enough? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? And if he says yes, I'll say, are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. He's not only telling me, he's making this statement to himself also. So this is something that's important. Yeah, I tell him you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, and it is a disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is I give him a copy of Clancy's 7 Questions. Clancy I is an icon in the recovery community in AA. It's 7 small questions, like a mini fourth step. A fourth step is an inventory, but this doesn't replace it. It just gives him an idea of what we're going to do in the and where we're going with this thing. Doesn't matter how he answers the question. Doesn't really matter that much. It's a good kickstart. What I want him to, what I want to see is if he's willing to go to that length, and this is a very small length, here's the questions. I need you to answer these questions, and I need him back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. You know, if he doesn't call, I'm okay with that too. That means two things. He's either not ready or he's not ready for me. And I just go on to the next guy. It's okay. If he does call, he's taken a simple instruction and he's done some work, and now I'm ready to put in my time and effort. I'm willing to put as much time and effort as he is, no more and no less. So I got the questions back, and one of the first assignments, I tell him he needs to get a home group. That's his lifeline group. And when he gets into the group, I want him to get a newcomer's packet or have a list go around with get men's names, boys with boys, girls with girls. This is about romance. It's not about romance. It's about life and death. So we find it to be sometimes inappropriate because it's very intimate. But if you can't find a like gender, you work the steps. That's the key. Got to work the 12 steps. So, okay, so you get these men's names, and you call them every day for the next 30 days, one guy, different guy every day, hopefully, and you ask permission to recite the third step prayer. The reason I have them do that, and I never give an assignment unless I tell them why or what principle I'm trying to get them to acknowledge, I get them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. It connects them up with their home group. They know their name. He knows their name. Third, it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, possibly the fellow he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol and probably will not. No guarantee, so your sponsee's already into service. It's a great kickstart. I find it to be very productive. I'm nobody special, but I found this to be, I don't put anything on the website that I haven't used and found to be productive. I don't work in theory. I work in practical application, like the 12 and 12, 12 steps and 12 traditions book is based on the experiences of using the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous over an extended period of time. Real important stuff. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Thank you. Well, Vincent, so now you're a writer and you're living in Southern California. So how did you find out? Were you born an alcoholic? Were you a self-made man? How did that all start out? How did you come into the rooms? Or what was early on? Yeah.
Well, the journey began for me on in September, Friday the 13th in 1985. I had called AA 6 months beforehand, and they were very nice, and they suggested that I go to a meeting at a church around the corner from my house, and I thanked them kindly and hung up the phone, and there wasn't a chance in the world I was going to set foot in a church. So I continued to drink for the next 6 months. And being in Southern California, also participate in a variety of other chemical attractions. I finally reached a point, though, to where I was just couldn't do it anymore. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. So I had made a deal with myself. There was a when I called the central office here in Orange County, I had written the name down along the margin in the phone book. Well, this is back in the day when phone books actually were big, thick books, unlike today. And the deal I made with myself was that if I could find that number in the phone book, not that I would call information again, I had to find it where I wrote it down on the margin, you see, I would call AA. Well, the powers that be, or a power greater than myself, looked down, and I think you know where this is going. I flipped open the phone book, and there was the number where I'd written it in the margin. So I'd made the deal. I'm sorry?
Just right where you flipped it up?
Right where I'd written, yeah, right there on that page. And at the time, the Orange County phone book was probably about 5 inches thick. So there it was. So I made the deal. So I went in and I called, but damn it, I wasn't going to go to a church. So if they suggested I go to a meeting in a church, it wasn't going to happen. This time, the guy answered the phone and said, well, how'd you like somebody to come out and talk to you? And for some reason, I said yes. So I hung up the phone and got a call back a couple minutes later from a guy by the name of Steve. And he wanted to know if I still wanted him and another guy to come over. And I said, sure. And he said, well, we'd be there in a little while. Well, back in the day when I was carrying on, a little while for me could have been anywhere from 15 minutes to never. So I stopped and lit up a cigarette and poured myself a double scotch and started looking around my abode thinking, you know, I probably should tidy up a little bit before these gentlemen show up at my house. And it would have taken a backhoe and a work crew a couple of days to clean up my place. It was so trashed. At about that time, though, there was a knock on the door. And here were these two fellows from Alcoholics Anonymous, Steve and Jeff. I invited them in, and they came in and sat down and started talking to me. Now, I still have a drink in my hand and a cigarette, and they just were giving me their best. And I'd love to tell you that I can remember the pearls of wisdom that they laid on me, and it changed my life. I didn't hear a damn thing. At some point during the course of the conversation, I decided it was a good idea to get up and pull down a .45 automatic from the top of my bookshelf. Got their attention. So as they're talking, or at least one of them was, the little guy, Jeff, he got real quiet and his eyes got real big. The tall guy, Steve, he started talking real fast. After a few minutes, I told him, well, I don't have any bullets. They were relieved. They also left in a big hurry. But as they were walking out the door, the tall guy, Steve, said, do you want to go to a meeting tomorrow? And for some reason, I said yes. Now, I never expected to hear from these guys again. I mean, they came to my house to help me, and what did I do? I scared the hell out of them with a gun. Well, that guy called me the next morning. I woke up. I had poured myself two fingers of scotch. It was the usual routine. Drink them down, throw them right back up, then light a cigarette, get my hands to stop from shaking. I went through that routine, threw up those two fingers of scotch. He picked me up, took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was Friday the 13th, September 1985, and I have not found it necessary to drink since.
Wow.
The obsession to drink was removed that very first day. I had tried to quit many times, and I had zero success. The best I'd been able to do was 18 hours, and that was literally sitting in my rocking chair watching my knuckles turn white, just not drinking. And at the end of 18 hours, it wasn't that I rewarded myself with a drink. I had to drink because my skin was crawling off. That first day in recovery, the obsession to drink was removed. Now I still had all the hallmarks and earmarks of an alcoholic, but that overwhelming, uncontrollable desire to drink was removed in that moment. And it has, to this day, has never returned. So by God's grace and my willingness, I have a little over 27 years of sobriety.
Wow. Congratulations. That's quite the hallmark. Tell me a little early on, though, when did you realize that you had a problem? Was it something you feel you were genetically predisposed? Was your dad a drunk? Was your family into alcohol and drugs? Or was it you had done over the time that all of a sudden you found that you developed the allergy?
No, my family were essentially teetotalers. My mom was the kind of gal that, you know, she'd have a half a glass of wine and say, oh, no more for me. I'm starting to feel it, you know. And, you know, my dad, you know, I saw him drunk a few times, but not many. Neither one of them were what you would call classic drug abusers. My dad used a little bit of medication, but not much. My mom, you know, she grew up in the era of, you know, Mother's Little Helpers. So she always had, you know, pill bottles around for something. I never got into them, though, for some reason. It never crossed my mind. I was too busy getting my stuff from my friends. But I grew up in a household that it just really never was an issue or talked about. And, you know, again, being a child of the 60s, I came of age. I got loaded and laid for the first time in the summer of love, 68. And it just started to happen for me. You know, the first time I drank, I was 8 years old. My buddy and I, his mom and dad, were having a bit of a whoopee party. And they drank martinis. They left the glasses and those nice carafes you make martinis in laying around, and they all had a little bit in the bottom of them. We poured it all together, and we got blottoed. And I liked the way it made me feel the first time I drank at 8 years old. I liked looking at the world through a different prism of consciousness, if you will. So the alcohol was great, and then the drugs were even better. And being a Southern Californian and growing up where I grew up and the time I grew up in, drugs are a huge part of my story. I'm a veteran of many, many psychedelic trips, and if it was available to do, I did it or tried it at least once. The thing of it was with me, and this goes back to something you touched on in the beginning of the show, that I was doing cocaine, and I did cocaine to the point to where all I had to do was look at a straw and my nose would start to bleed, so I quit doing it. I did crystal meth and speed to the point where I was having psychotic episodes. I was walking around with a gun in my belt because I knew they were out to get me. I don't know who they were, but I knew they were out to get me. And I knew that probably wasn't a good way to live, so I just stopped doing it. One day it dawned on me, I've been loaded on pot every day for the last 10 years. And I figured, well, you know, maybe I should quit smoking joints. And I did. It was no big deal. But when it came time to quit drinking, I was powerless. I could not stop. And it drove me, finally, the last 5 years or so that I drank, there was some drug use, but it was mostly alcohol. Alcohol was my solution to all of my problems. If it was a good day, you know, let's celebrate. If it was a bad day, well, I need a drink. And if nothing was going on, well, hell, let's go to the bar and see what's happening. It was always with me. It cost me a career in the computer industry, a better part of $1 million, a marriage, you know, self-respect and everything that goes along with it.
Yeah, it's a, I think the big book calls it a rapacious creditor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I looked that up, and it was unyielding and unforgiving. Definitely,
well,
that's alcohol.
And on page 151, it talks about the hideous four horsemen. I recall the first time I read that or heard that in an AA meeting, it struck home with me because it was. You know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I didn't have a clue what to do or how to go about it. And being someone of fairly strong willpower, I was amazed that I couldn't. It's an inanimate object. How can something which doesn't have a mind of its own, which today I don't know if it does or not really, but something that is just in a bottle have so much control in my life? And it did. It controlled every aspect of my living. I lived to drink, and I drank to live. And today I don't have to live that way. To come back to the point that you touched on earlier, all the different 12-step programs that are out there today, the big book, it's kind of like baking a cake. There's a basic foundational recipe for baking a cake, and you got to have all the ingredients in it. You know, now, you can add different things to it later on down the road, but you got to bake the cake, and you got to follow the ingredients as they're laid out. The 12 steps as they were laid down in late 1938, early 1939, they still work today. You know, so many people get caught up in, well, you know, I'm not really an alcoholic. You know, my problem is benzos. My problem is heroin. Well, if you can let go of the active ingredient and actually apply the principles as they're laid down, it'll work for you. You know, another analogy for it is like, you know, taking a trip. I don't care where you're going. Say you decide to go to Chicago. There's lots of ways to get there. You can walk. You can ride. You can fly. You can ride a lawnmower. You can jog. You can go get there by way of New Delhi. You know, and you'll have an interesting trip and a lot of interesting experiences different from everybody else. But the point of the journey is to get to Chicago. The point of the journey with recovery is to get and stay sober one day at a time and to be free. How I get to recovery makes for an interesting tale. But what's important is what am I doing today in order to hold on to my seat and not have to drink or use. And if we can agree on that, we can accomplish a great deal.
You had mentioned that you hadn't drank from the first meeting, and that was kind of interesting. I did a post, and I got this. It's on when can someone start to sponsor, and this came out of the Grapevine, 1950 Grapevine. I've heard of a person being dry one day and going to a 12-step call with excellent and enduring results for both parties. That's the AA Grapevine, May 1950, Volume 6, Number 12. I like to think that Bill W. Worked his entire program with Ebby T. in less than 7 days and immediately started working with the other alcoholics. Ebby T. was only 60 days sober when he carried the message to Bill W., and Dr. Bob was only 3 days sober when him and Bill W. carried the message to AH number 3, Bill Duff. So I believe that sometimes it doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out affair. If you've had enough and someone's there and you're ready to go, you're ready. I don't think relapse, it doesn't have to be an option. Some folks get in, you know, they call them, actually it's almost like a derogatory term I've heard sometimes, a one-chip wonder. Mm-hmm. They've gotten one chip. But I'm glad to hear that that's the way it worked out. But it works out different for everybody. There's really no template. But I've experienced that when you've had enough and you get good solid direction early on in your sobriety, it makes a really huge difference. Bill W. said good sponsorship can make the difference between life and death. So you had a good sponsor.
Yeah, well, one of the fellows at 12-Step, he was my first sponsor for my first year, and I was at a sober softball tournament, and they were short umpires, so I was gang-pressed into being an umpire. And he came walking by me with fire in his eye and a bat in his hand chasing down a guy from another team, and he looked at me, and I must have had a very unusual look on my face, and he stopped for a second and said, do as I say, not as I do, and he continued chasing after the guy with the bat. I knew I was sober long enough at that point to know that that's probably not what I want. You know, I want people who walk the way they talk. So I let him go. I'm on my third sponsor. The man who's my sponsor today was at the first meeting I attended. He was there in case I brought a gun. He's a retired. There's no such thing as a retired Marine, but he served in the Marine Corps in the Vietnam War, and he was going to jump on me in case I produced that 45 at an AA meeting. I've known him since day one, and he became my sponsor, I guess, when I was about 4 or 5 years sober. So he's been my sponsor now for 22-plus years. You know, our relationship today is a lot different, of course, but, hey, there are still times when my mind, which is the mind of a chronic alcoholic, will still come up with interesting solutions to the things in my life. And when I have one of those and it doesn't sound quite right, I still will run stuff by him to this day. And he will call me as well. We've known each other for a long time. But without the connection, when Bill and Bob and the early members started working with others, they found that was the thing that set this apart, was that one alcoholic sitting down talking to another, there's a shorthand that we have, or if you prefer, the language of the heart that takes place when two of us get together and we start telling the truth to one another. You know, I've been doing this for a while now, and doing it professionally and in teaching and starting back to basics groups. I have instructed over 1,000 people now in how to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Really?
Yeah, in that it states, you know, at the beginning of the fifth chapter, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, I know this is anecdotal and it is only from my perspective, but I have yet to see anyone fail who has worked the steps as they were written and as they were intended. I've watched a lot of people fail, and I've watched them come back and say, AA doesn't work. But, you know, if I can set them down within 30 seconds, I can get them to see to where it wasn't the program that failed them. It was their inability and their willingness to actually follow the directions that were given to them. You know, there was a reason they were holding back a little something. They had a secret, or they didn't think they needed to work with others, or, oh, prayer and meditation, yeah, you know, I don't really have time for it. There was always a reason why, so they never truly worked the steps. Again, it comes back to making that cake. You know, if you go to make a cake and you decide to leave out the eggs, or if it says cook it at 325 for 15 minutes and you decide to cook it at 500 for a half an hour, you may get something out of the oven, but it isn't going to be cake and it's not going to be edible. If we can follow the directions, that simple set of directions that were laid down again at the end of 38, the first part of 39, it's amazing the changes that will take place in a person's life.
Very good. I like that in the preamble where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. To those that will not or cannot give themselves to this simple program, they're such unfortunates. They seem to have been born that way.
There are too those who have grave mental and emotional disorders. They too can get well if they have the capacity to be honest.
To be honest, absolutely.
Yeah, and part of the honesty is working an honest program. Some folks just can't do it. I've seen it myself many times.
Yeah.
They eventually, and some, you know, and the truth of it is, I've seen some that didn't go out, but they really never expanded their spiritual experience. But they, you know, they stayed sober, and I'm not here to judge anybody's sobriety. But I'll tell you this: if they're in the program of recovery and they're not working the steps, they're not in recovery. It might be a member of a program, true. You're a member if you say you're a member. That's in the third tradition. But unless they're working the steps, they might be sober, but they're not in recovery.
Well, as you well know, there's promises throughout the Big Book, and part of the description of someone who's in recovery is being able to meet calamity with serenity, knowing how to intuitively handle those situations which used to baffle us. You know, the people who are in recovery, to kind of expand on the point a little bit, you can see them in meetings. They have a smile on their face. And you might sit them down and talk to them after the meeting and find out that, you know, they were diagnosed with cancer or there's something going on in their lives. But yet they look at it with a different perspective because they understand that there is something greater than them going on. There is a power greater than themselves. And one of the first steps in truly understanding how everything works is when we come to the realization that we are mortal and that the day will come that this flesh will fail. So what am I really doing? And what I'm doing here for me is that I'm trying to be the best servant that I possibly can be to God and the people about me. You know, I believe that there is a power greater than myself, and I found it as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into the rooms a raging agnostic. I mean, I had an answer for everything. I had read all the great philosophers, and I could quote them, and I could tear down your Christianity and your religious beliefs until you would walk away shaking your head. I would greet Jehovah's Witnesses at my front door, and I would give them information to walk away with. You know, I was that kind of a guy, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous all filled with all of this stuff, and they taught me how to let it go. They introduced me to the set-aside prayer. And you find that in the chapter to the agnostic. And what I had to do is I just had to take, I didn't have to give it up, but I just had to set it aside for a little while. So just took it a different way. All the things that you thought and all the things that you believed, you know, your best thinking brought you to recovery. So why don't you give this a try and maybe your life will change. And through that simple admonition by just, okay, I saw some, probably some good information over here, but I'm just going to follow these guys around for a while and I'm going to do what I'm told. You know, I'm going to go to H&I, I'm going to go on panels, I'm going to tag along on 12-step calls, I'm going to show up at the meetings early, I'm going to make coffee, and back in the day you actually cleaned ashtrays, and do those kinds of things. And I mean, there were lots of times when I'm standing there, I'm the guy taking care of cleaning up cigarette butts and cleaning coffee cups, and I'm watching somebody stamp a cigarette out on the floor, and I want to get in their face so bad, and my sponsor said, nope, your job is to clean it up after they're done. You know, there are so many little lessons that I had to learn early in sobriety, and I would not have learned them had it not been for good sponsorship and people around me to show me the way, because my head would have ran me out of Alcoholics Anonymous in a heartbeat.
Interesting, you were agnostic. Harold, are you still there?
Yes.
Harold came in as an atheist. You know what an atheist is? An atheist says there is no God and lives like there is one. And the agnostic says there might be a God and lives like there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Harold now is completely... Harold, what's your persuasion now after, would you say, 25, 26 years?
Well, at first I was raised, and my brothers and I were raised on self-reliance. You can do anything you put your mind to, like Muhammad Ali. You are the greatest. I am the greatest. But after a while, and science and anthropology really helped a lot, I began to study the Bible and the so-called inconsistencies there, and found some very interesting ideas. So now I'm a follower of Jesus Christ and very dedicated to the gospel, and I take Celebrate Recovery into the Harris County jails on a weekly basis, doing my institutions and hospitals work, and it's really an honor. So my spiritual growth, if AA hadn't been there, I would have of course never found a true understanding, would have never found the truth, because I wouldn't have lived long enough. So but it's an ongoing process, and I still study the Bible on a daily basis. Joseph?
Thank you, Hal. And I think the point is that part of recovery, in my experience, is that we need to continue to expand our spiritual experience. Bill W. said, AA was spiritual kindergarten. And from that point on, that's fine. You can use a rock, a tree, the God of your fathers. We don't care what higher power. It could be the height of a tower, or no more than a head and shoulder above you. But there's something that you have to acknowledge as greater than you. The ego will not allow this. There's nothing bigger than a drug addict or an alcoholic's ego. And to admit that there's something that he can't handle and he can't do is really too much for the ego.
My first higher power was the group itself. I realized that alcohol was a power greater than me, and I began to see that the group, of course, was a power greater than me. My first sponsor was 6'4", 285. He was a power greater than me, and it fit together quite well.
I have you have one thing. You had mentioned the Four Horsemen. I had a little thing I had gotten and written part of it up. In dramatic lore, they're known as destruction, pestilence, famine, and death. These are only aliases. Their real names are terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, guaranteed by Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, Ernest, and Julio Gallo. The terror of being conquered by a more powerful foe, it was too much for us. Alone, there was one who had all power. That one was God. May you find him now. Action cures fear. Inaction creates terror. Douglas Horton. I wanted to read now. You had written a book some time ago, Tower Height Chronicled.
Yeah, High Tower Chronicled.
Right.
Yeah, it was one of those that was a direct deal with God, actually. I had the first 10 years I was sober, my health was just outstanding. And like the song says, you don't know what you got till it's gone. And at about 10 years of sobriety, I developed a blood disorder that they never did figure out what it was, but it almost killed me. I made a deal with God. I had a lot of things that I wanted to do, you know, the old sitting on the bar stool and I'm gunna's. And I had not accomplished all of them yet. I was working toward them, though, at that point. But one of them was writing a book and getting it published. So I made a deal with God that asked him to let me live long enough to finish one book and get it published. And, you know, the alcoholic mind kicks in, well, I'll just drag my feet on this thing. I could live to be 1,000 years old. He buys that deal. But I did. I went ahead and I got working on it. I worked on it diligently. And about a year and a half later, the book was published. And it's an odd little book in that it deals with sobriety and it deals with recovery, and there's aliens and Australians and recovery houses and all kinds of interesting things in it. But it was a little bit of a walk around inside my head at around 12 years of sobriety, and it's available through all the usual suspects, and it's for Kindle and all the rest of it. And you know, if you find yourself interested in those types of things, hopefully it'll give you a chuckle and maybe give you pause to think as well. I also write daily on spiritual matters on Blogspot. My blog on Blogspot is it's titled Just for Today, but its URL is Living in Spirit, one word. I, too, am an ordained minister today. I found my path to Jesus through Emma Fox, one of the seminal Christian teachers of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Igor Sikorsky Jr.'s book, The Godparents of Alcoholics Anonymous. He lists Emmett Fox as one of AA's godparents. And he answered the questions for me. I had questions about Scripture and some of the things that I had heard about Christianity that didn't make any sense, and he answered those questions for me. So through him, I was able to turn my will and my life over to the care of Jesus Christ. And that was, gosh, nearly 20 years ago now.
And you said it's livinginthespirit.com?
Yeah, that's a URL, a blog spot, Living in Spirit.
Living in Spirit. One word or three words?
That's yes, one word.
One word, in .com?
Yeah. Now, I've been writing on that now for about 3 or 4 years, and it's interesting that a significant portion of my audience today is in some of the countries where Christianity and God has been unavailable for many years, particularly the Eastern Bloc. I have a lot of followers in Russia and in that area of the world.
Oh, interesting. You might find this interesting a little bit, too. On our analytics at Rum Radio, we've been at it about 3 years. We just went over 200,000 hits, so I could see a daily on what countries. And for some time, it ebbs and flows, but we were up just recently up to 2,000 hits in the moving week in Beijing, China.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's because Rum Radio has a spiritual lilt to it, and that they've been deprived from any kind of spirituality for so long that they find it interesting. But I really don't know for sure, because and then all of a sudden the numbers cut down. So one of the techies told me it was called the Great Firewall of China, and that the censors get in there. And if there's something that too many people find interesting, they kind of pull it up. I think it's the collective. They don't want to see any groups gathering. It's a threat to their political power. The good news is that they're learning how to bypass the censors by doing virtual computer programs, so where they can get around them and make their own access. So things are starting to change. I have a chapter from your book, if I may.
Please.
When Roland Hightower left Vietnam, a decorated veteran with connections that would bring him fame and fortune, he believed he had a destiny to fulfill, and more importantly, had all the answers to the questions of life. After indulging in all manner of excesses, seemingly without thought or care of the consequences, he found himself bankrupt in every area of his life. Despairing from the self-imposed crisis of spirit, he nearly ended it all in an alcohol-induced blackout. From this physical and mental bottom, with help from a long-dead doctor and a stockbroker and the movement they began, Roland found a new life and a new way of living. Little did he know that this was only the beginning in a journey that would not only change him beyond recognition, but the world as we know it as well. Very interesting. That's an interesting introduction. So this is sort of your alter ego. Roland is your alter ego?
A bit. The suicide... that is actually a true story in my case. When I was drinking, my wife had left, and the house was being sold, and we had a great big picture window, and I was sitting there and drinking, and I had that 45 in my hand, and I had made the decision I was going to end it all, and I wrote a suicide note, and then somewhere along the line, I blacked out. When I came to the next day, the sun was up, and I looked down, and I read that suicide note, and it was, without a doubt, the world's worst suicide note ever. I am so glad that no one ever saw it other than me. And the 45.
I mean,
was
as a writer,
there.
it would have been embarrassing as a writer.
Oh, it would have haunted me to in the grave. Yeah, I would have been drummed out of anything in heaven with do anything with any kind of a pen. But I looked down at that 45, and the hammer was down. And I thought, well, I just must put the hammer down on it. But it bothered me. So I finally dropped the magazine out of it, and I ratcheted it back, and the shell that was in the chamber had been dimpled. At some point during the night, I had pulled the trigger on that weapon, and the shell did not fire. I'd love to tell you that it was the next day that I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, but it took me another 6 months or so. But, yeah, there's throughout my sobriety, there have been instances like that where there has been either it's just blind, dumb luck or intervention of something greater than myself. But I had put that gun to my head at some point, and I had pulled the trigger on it, and the round did not fire.
That's amazing. I've heard that story before from other folks. I mean, it's not just a coincidence that they didn't go off, that I had this. Two others I've heard personally, but I've been around. I'm coming up 16 years, so you go to enough meetings, you're going to hear. Everything's going to pass by if you live long enough. And I've heard that where people have put the gun to their mouth or to the head, pulled the trigger, and you know who it is? Harold Johnny the Poet in Lamplighters.
I see.
He tells that story where he pulls the trigger and the gun doesn't discharge, which is very unusual. Guns today, most guns are fairly well machined. I mean, unless it's a Saturday night nickel special or something where they might have a misfire. But it's pretty rare that a gun doesn't misfire.
No, I took the weapon out in the backyard and I ratcheted another round in it and it fired right away. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's my experience. I had been in Vietnam and been around a lot of weapons, and I was a machine gunner and a tanker and all that, so I small arms. So very rare. I mean, I could count on one hand out of thousands of attempts that a gun would misfire. It's a fairly rare occasion. It's really a spiritual consideration. I would make no doubt about it. My experience is that you always give the credit to God.
Absolutely.
Always. This way there's never any, it was about me or anything. No, you give it to God. God had something other work for you to do. And evidently it sounds like you're doing it. So now you're sponsoring people now, your sponsor, right?
Yes, I work with folks that I've been told that I can be a bit intimidating from time to time. But, as my sponsor said to me early on, we work with anybody and everybody. There is no pecking order, and there's no deciding, well, I don't think I'm the right person for you. If it looks like they're interested in something that you have to say, then by all means work with them. And when it's time not to, then you won't. It's a simple deal, really. When you work for God, you work with anybody and everybody. And you stick your hand out, and you give them your number. And, when I was on the speaker circuit a number of years ago, I would have, 15, 20 people after a pitch come up and, oh, I love you, you'd be my sponsor, give me your number. And if I had a nickel for every one of those people that I'd given my number to, hell, I could fill up my truck with gas, even at today's prices. All I can do is what I can do and tell the truth to the best of my ability. The unfortunate thing about it today in sobriety is that there are so many people who just don't want to hear it. They don't want to talk about the steps, it was the 1930s, and the world has changed a lot.
Oh, I know. I say that all the time.
Well, God hasn't changed any, and the process that those guys came up with, when you think back upon it, you've got this broken-down stockbroker. You've got this discredited doctor and a group of these other ne'er-do-wells who all of them had less than 4 years of sobriety, and they all get together and they come up with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it truly is if there wasn't angels on their shoulders whispering in their ears, then, I don't know what to say. It is truly a remarkable work, and it still works today. I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and those that I've seen adhere to the process, as it is written in that silly old book, it really works, and lives change. You see the lights come on in their eyes. There is probably no greater gift that I have ever received in my life than sitting across a table from someone in that moment, and you see the spark of the divine
light in their eyes.
Uh-huh. The hair is standing up on the back of my neck right now. It is an amazing moment. And it happens, and it's got nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with the willingness to follow the steps as they are intended and actually apply them one day at a time. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's. Thank you for that. I've had the experience, and you see the light come on. I had an experience with just recently, fella, Kelly, you know him.
Yeah.
And Harold knows. I don't. I think probably not the same Kelly, but somebody in a former home group. And everybody tries Kelly. I mean, Kelly wants, he kind of wants to want to, but he's a chronic relapser. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of settled in. He's in my neighborhood, and I see him almost every day. He's the last house as I leave the subdivision. We wave all the time. And he asked me finally, says, that, you know, would you be my sponsor? And I kept asking, have you had enough? And he couldn't give me he couldn't say yes. And I says, Kelly, you're going to waste my time and I'm going to waste your time. Until you have had enough, we're not going anywhere. But, hey, keep coming back. You know, like, eventually you might get it. I says, and then again, you know, you might be the chronic type that you this is it. You know, just you're going to have to realize when you've had enough. And, you know, it might take a tragedy, whatever. So, anyway, so finally I kept playing coy with him, and I wouldn't bite, and finally said, I've had enough. Hmm. And I think he's just said that so I would sponsor him. You know, that was, you know, an alcoholic will do whatever he needs to do to get whatever he thinks he wants at the time. So, yes, okay. All right, so we start working the steps. We work the first three steps, and we're coming out of Randall's. Yeah, we were working the steps in a coffee area over there. And he looks around, and it's early spring, this spring, and he looks around and he says, well, you know, I never noticed the trees are that green, and the sky is really blue, and what a beautiful day, and, you know, just blah, blah. And the first three steps, right? And we hadn't really done the work yet. To me, you could do the first three steps sitting at a traffic light, you know, and the work starts on four. But at least he got that far. He had never gotten that far before. And I said, oh, thank goodness, he's starting to get it. And right after that, almost within a few days, he was drunk again.
Yeah.
And you know why? He was uncomfortable having serenity.
Yep.
It was so alien to him that he couldn't wait to get back into the drama and the chaos of alcoholism. He lived there. That was his home. I used to say, I used to live in hell, but I knew where all the light switches were.
Right. And well, as an old-timer
serenity,
said to me.
Well, go ahead.
Because as an old-timer said to me early on, Irish Annie, she passed away a few years ago. She's a rather famous circuit speaker, but yeah, I'll clean it up a little bit. You know, I may be living in crap, but at least it's my crap, and it's warm and familiar. And so many succumb to that.
I know,
no, it's
and,
really
and
bad.
Harold, what are you going to say?
Yeah, just it's so sad. But as you and I have talked many times, Joseph, that until the pain of staying in the addiction is greater than the pain of recovery, people won't get recovery.
I usually suggest to my sponsees, in one of the first assignments, is I ask them, I suggest, and it's all suggestion, which is a subtle command, but it's just suggested. This book is meant to be only suggestive because we know so little. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us, and the book is set up that way. It's suggestive. Everyone has, I like to think, a free will or free agency. Everyone's an agent unto themselves. They make that decision. The sponsor leads them to a relationship with God. And that's what the sponsor does, basically, by working the 12th step, which is the repentance process for children. So we get to a certain point, and then they have to realize that, hey, I got to let him go. You know, this is now he's got to depend on God. He can't depend on the sponsor. But I ask them not to speak in the meetings until they work step five. The goal is to get you through in 30 to 45 days. On the website, I have Michael M., who has the videos, and I got a whole post on it
12 and 24 at Dr. Bob times 5,000. So you have the written and the videos how to take somebody through the 12 steps using only the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in 24 hours. You don't have to do it in 24 hours. You can do 48 hours or 72 hours. You can take a week. But all the information is available, and it's in video and audio. And the reason I don't have them speak, my goal is 30 to 45 days. That's the way usually it works out. I very rarely get them through that quick. Usually they kind of linger on. What happens is they get a life. Now these guys get a life. They don't have as much time to work the steps. So that's why it's good to get them through quickly. Joe McHugh, no speaking in the meetings, no sharing in the meetings until you've worked step five. And the reason I do that, and people say, well, why do you do? Well, we need to hear what their pain so we can relate to it, and they need to get it off their chest, and that's the problem. First of all, I don't think we need to hear it. If you forgot what it was like, then you're prone to get it back again. Yeah, everybody remembers. I can't remember anybody who didn't remember. I remember. The other thing is that pain that they have is dispersed when they speak in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. It dissipates. It just does. You know, they're being accepted into a new group. It's a heady thing. You're encouraged. Oh, you're new. We want to hear from you. So all that pain and all they getting it off their chest, and then all of a sudden the pink cloud starts dropping down. They're not drinking. You know, everything's getting better, and now you can't get them to hardly work the steps anymore. They're staying sober. Is that not enough? So no talking. And now by step five, I tell them, you know, you're available now to be a temporary sponsor. All sponsorship is temporary. It's either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime or anywhere in between. The key is to work the steps. So, and the one agreement is you have to stay one step ahead of your sponsee. Most won't do that, but it primes them to get into action as quickly as possible. And the one immunity we have from alcoholism is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when all other activities fail. Anyway, so that's enough out of me. Do you have any closing comments, Vincent?
No, it's been a pleasure. A pleasure meeting you and your sponsor. I've enjoyed the time, and as always, you know, if there's anything I can ever do to be of service to you or anyone else in any way, please do not hesitate to contact me, because my sobriety is contingent upon my willingness to be of service to others, and so far it's kept me in pretty good stead, you know, one day at a time.
It sounds that way. One day at a time. I know you're going to – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. One day at a time. That's our deal. No one has more sobriety than the guy that woke up this morning. It really is a one day. Everybody is one drink away, one drug away, one behavior away from a relapse. And we have to keep that in mind. The disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups. I've seen people go out there for long periods of time. They were living on that spiritual experience they had a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. 20 years ago, they talked in the meetings, they sponsored other guys, and failed to expand their spiritual experience. I call it restless laurelitis. And they go back out, and everybody goes, what happened? And that it's like, if he went out, what chance do I have? You don't have to go out. All you need to do is work an honest program. You got to have a sponsor, like an American Express card. You never leave home without one. And it's a tourniquet of accountability. That's what a sponsor does. And keep on keeping on. One thing, though, if you're asking, Vincent, that suggestion about the meeting that I had earlier when we were talking, if you want to would write that up, look on the website. It's under meetings in your neck of the woods. If you could put a section in on that particular kind of meeting, the old timers, the way they back to basics when they did it initially, how those meetings were conducted. I didn't know that, and I think that would be good information to pass around. There are some people reading the stuff, and you never know, you know, who's gonna pick it up and run to the ball. So that would be great if you'd be interested in doing that.
Be my pleasure.
Right, Harold, do you have any last words?
Well, it's been great speaking with you too. It's been a great meeting, and I just want to encourage people to do the six things in the morning. Read some literature, recovery literature. Call your sponsor. Go to a meeting. Work the steps with a pen and paper and your sponsor, and pray, and no matter what, between the time you get up and the time you go to bed, don't drink or drug, no matter what. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Harold. In closing, Rum Radio is in 150 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,600 towns, cities, and villages, and we had just gone over 200,000 hits since September 10th, 09, so 3 years, 3.5 months, something like that, 3 months. It's building. It's getting around. Good information. No money's being made, and we try to remain anonymous to the 11 tradition. This is not about any individual. This is a group effort. We have nobody's in charge. We have trusted servants. That means that our effort is to help the next guy. That's what keeps us sober. In our meetings, we discuss our experience, strength, and hope. Experience is an inventory of our past mistakes. That's how we relate to each other. Strength is the ability to lift or carry. We lift our fellows and we carry the message of recovery. That's what keeps us sober. And hope is the belief that our lives will continue to improve when we do the next right thing. And that next right thing is not to take that first drink of alcohol, that next hit of crack, that next shot of dope. To clean house is suggested in the 12 steps found in our basic text, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or your program literature, and to trust in God and the process he gave us. So thanks for listening, everybody. Good night, Vincent, and good night, Harold. And we'll see you on the radio.
Good night.
RumRadio.org. Good night.